You're listening to Subsound Radio. We bring you streaming and live broadcasting from the capital. This is the El Arpa Podcast. What's brown grains going 20 kilometers per hour? Maria in her car. Welcome to the El Arpa Podcast on wheels. We are currently doing the locomotion in motion on a car, four wheels, driving around the city. This is a bit weird, isn't it? This is literally the podcast on tour.
Yeah.
Is this illegal? Is there a statute or a law that says podcasting while driving is illegal?
Podcasting while driving,
yeah. Well, podcasting has a priority, so while driving, while podcasting.
Yes, mainly because we've just been around the globe four times.
Exactly, yeah. Well, welcome back to a new edition. We're going to catch up with the most exciting part of last week's podcast, which were the clay plots. Clay plots! Why do I keep saying clay plots?
I don't know. I'm starting to think they do exist, you know?
You found some fabric. Stole the balls off the breast. You found some fabric.
Yeah, that's confidential information.
Well, it can't be released yet, boy. Is this under wraps technically in the university?
Yes. No, but we don't know what it is yet, so.
So you can't talk about it. Probably some. You know, lecturer on day release, you know, kind of like doing like work experience, and their jumper from Primark got caught in the clay plot. That's basically what it is.
Probably, yes. Isn't but it? I will confirm next week.
Next week. When are the results in?
Thursday.
Okay.
Because we'll be taking photographs, macro photographs.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah, and we'll see them.
Sorry, this taxi driver just gave me, and we're getting a lot of funny looks from passing traffic because they see a microphone and people talking. I could just be holding this microphone. They don't know we're actually recording.
Yeah,
so,
no, we're recording. No.
So until they had that information, it's quite judgmental. And the question of why we're doing this in the car, I don't know.
For the crack.
Well, exactly. Well, we're coming up to this is essentially our Easter podcast. So what I do know is that part two is coming up momentarily after this musical
traffic lights,
Torrijas. if you don't know what they are, you're better off. Musical interlude. See you in part two. The Cigar Box by Joseph Roth. Even the world of dives has its symbols and its holy signs. A drum, for instance, is the emblem for a stout, respectable club with gold lace, and the sign of a burglar is a cigar box. The cigar box contains not Dutch cigars, but, arranged by size, rippers and jacks and little aldermen, or jimmies and claw jimmies. Because in the world of dives, even housebreakers' tools have their nicknames. A picklock is a little alderman, a crowbar is a jimmy, and a drilling tool, which admittedly has become almost obsolete as a tool of civilization, is a ripper. A man who works with rippers cannot gain my respect. He's a dinosaur. A self-respecting man earns his living with explosives, oxygen, and dynamite. A ripper. Get away! The cigar box also contains a few S-hooks. S-hooks are so called because they have the shape of a Roman S. An S-hook is enough to take care of your average apartment door. Franz, though, never carries any S-hooks. He opens apartment doors that get in his way with his penknife. Franz is a skilled operator. That's a segment from a story by Joseph Roth from a book called What I Saw, Reports from Berlin, 1920 to 1933.
So we play some classical music now.
That's all from Sunday Miscellany. it's a book I'm reading by, from the aforementioned Joseph Roth. That's the first you've heard. You've heard me talking about the book, but this is the first you've actually heard the words from the man himself.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes from a segment where he's describing different bars around Berlin, as you can probably guess. And in this bar, he's talking about the less trustworthy folk and the tools they use to enter houses and to burgle. And it comes from a section called the Displaced Person. So he talks about homeless people, refugees, and people who perhaps have to turn to other sources of income in times of economic need. So, economic to clay, what's the word? Clay stories, clay plots.
Clay plots.
My language is failing me this week. But this this was a segment you heard. So what was your reaction to what I just read?
It seems like he's a very good observer.
Yeah, he is a very good observer. He is very famous in German-speaking countries. We're not familiar with him in this side of the world, but that is slowly changing. He was a prolific writer. He was never seen without a photograph, without a newspaper and a photograph. Jesus, I can't speak. He was paid a delicious amount of one Deutschmark or $1 per line, whatever they were dealing with back then, pennies, buttons, pen caps or Deutschmarks. He was paid one of those shiny things per line. And he was one of the most renowned journalists of his time. Wrote several novels as well. A lot of novels. Kind of dealing with a lot of the same things. Some about Russia. Some about people coming back after the First World War and the effects of that. And also several that talk about the and warn against the rise of fascism. And even Hitler gets name checked in a novel, one of his novels, and I think that was written in 1933. So even at that relatively early stage, he was quite concerned about the rise of fascism. Ended up leaving Berlin and being exiled and dying penniless, as can happen to many writers in Paris, France. So he's kind of a guy who's traveled a lot, was born in the far extremes of the Austrian-Hungarian Empire, which actually was Spain. So even though he's kind of born in Spain, but he came from a German family, spent some time in the war. And, well, as you can guess, this book is about a city that he loved. It was a magnet for artists during this period. And it's some in some ways very distinctive, seems like a very faraway place, and in another sense seems very reachable. It seems very close to what we know and recognize. He's talking about a changing city, a modernizing city, and kind of what you can see throughout the story, throughout the true story. These are all real accounts of real people. Is a great humanity and a great fondness for displaced people, for refugees and for people without much hope, for example. And sometimes he pokes fun at them. Sometimes he uses language which seems a little bit strange in comparison to our perspectives today, especially when talking about Jewish people. But he was a supporter. He wasn't anti-Semitic or anything. But ultimately, he kind of gives portraits of people in a very affectionate, if not a little sardonic as well, way. So he talks about one Russian general who was a refugee, and every day he was polishing his uniform, showing off his hat, because his hat was like an article that showed his original status, and he was like always saying, "Where are my divisions? Where are my soldiers?" And he collected things with great interest because it was part of his nature, and he guarded the little things that he had because they were like the link to his past. Basically, he was exiled from his country after the 1917 Russian Revolution, which is the anniversary this year, of course, in October later in the year. And he was of a different time. In a sense, maybe Joseph Roth is also of a different time in some respects, because his Europe was definitely falling away, even though he was cataloguing the modernization of Berlin, and by extension Europe through some of his stories. And like as we saw in that passage there as well with the cigar box, he's talking about the different people and their kind of their articles and during their work. that they use for their work. And he goes on to say in the latter part of the story, and this book is comprised of little sketches, so chapters could be literally 3 pages long, and he's focusing on one aspect of a story and approaching it in a very different way. And he goes on to say in this story about the cigar box, how the cigar box always had to be old. It always had to be filled with specific things, and how this, it was a big no-no if you entered the house without the proper equipment. So how even in this sketchy world you had a code of ethics, for example, and that's kind of something that runs throughout the book. People who have these physical things that either represent something they had, are currently, or want to be, for example, he describes the homeless people, how they're given bad clothes, and how they're dressed in ill-fitting clothes, and how some people kind of want to keep their clothes because they're not sure if they'll, you know, the replacements they're given will be adequate, even though the clothes that they actually have, their own property, are full of lice and everything as well. So he's kind of showing the two faces, the artistic, the kind of seedy side of things as well, and the growth of the city. Because for a moment in time, 1914, like the center of Berlin was the busiest center, city center in Europe, you know, so a lot of things were happening. And it coincides with the Weimar Republic, and they mentioned here in the notes, the translator's notes as well. It was a republic that was a very weak republic, had to be held together, opposing the extremes of communism and fascism, and how it was a very brief moment in German history, which eventually gave way to fascism, and of course the post-war period and modern united Germany. So it's a grand sweep, wouldn't you say? For example, it's an epic story. For example, I've only read half of it, so I haven't gone through the other parts of it yet. But what I have read so far, he talks about, for example, the Jewish quarter. So he talks about the Jews, and also as well about their attempts to settle in Palestine, which of course would come to fruition after the Second World War. And in some respects, it kind of can appear that he's not so fond of them. He's quite critical of them. But in other senses as well, he feels like that they deserve to have a place, right? They don't deserve to be persecuted, obviously. So he's speaking from a very humane angle when he's approaching the subject. But also he mentions, you know, how in Israeli news, or not in Jewish newspapers, he's hearing about atrocities perpetrated against the Jews and Palestinians by the Palestinians, and he's equating it to other conflicts around the world, and he's basically kind of predicting what's happening currently, where he's criticizing the Israelis and the Jews for acting out in violence to stop people perpetrating violence against them. So a lot of the rhetoric of modern times he's kind of referencing a little bit in these short passages. Of course, I mentioned displaced persons as well, refugees, and people who, we did a podcast before about the Salvados boat, which was helping refugees, African asylum seekers who are on little rickety boats trying to make their way to Europe. Mm-hmm. And one guy was talking about how much he wanted to work, and there's characters in this chapter as well who are just talking about their plans for the future and how they want to work, you know. So, and also as well, there's a part called Traffic, which is part 4, which I'm halfway through, and he's talking about a guy who's been in jail for 50 years. He's released in 1931, maybe, or maybe the latter part in the 1920s. He's lost, basically, because the city has changed quite so much, but he's so much energy, he just wants to work, he wants to kind of get the grips with the city. So this, even though it's very alien, and it's changed a lot, and there's cars replacing horses, the city itself has this energy that gives to the people, and that just makes people want to move, makes them want to work or to be involved in some way. So, well,
what was the purpose of he's recording all these things? Is it because it's not a novel? He's describing things, but.
It's not a novel, no. This was a great period for newspapers all over the world. There were hundreds of newspapers. He loved newspapers. He even kind of criticized newspapers of the far right.
Was he a journalist?
He's a journalist, yeah. And he said, I'm the only person who buys these shitty papers. So I think he just wanted to document everything. I mean, why did Neruda want to document all the plants and all the animals? It was just a compulsion that he had. And as I mentioned earlier, he was never seen without a newspaper in a photograph. There are not many photographs of him, but of all the photographs, he's holding a newspaper in it, and he wrote almost every day and about everything. And I'm not sure why he does it, but I think he also felt, they mentioned in the translation notes that he kind of had a lot more optimism about humanity, and then he saw how people were trampled on and were denied rights, and he became kind of more bleak and negative, and I think he felt very world weary, and he wanted to transmit that through his stories, either because he wanted to make a point to how there's people who need help, but also as well, he just, as a comment on the times, that these things are wrong, and they made him very very depressed, for example. So I think that's what the translator says. He knows better than me. I think that does bear fruit in the, if you're reading the book, I think you can see that happening a little bit. And I think by the end of his life, he was quite despondent and had been beaten down by a lot of things that had happened, that he observed happening to other people, and things that he saw on a grander scale, such as I mentioned earlier, the rise of fascism as well. So he's a man who I think who felt things very deeply and who felt things very sensitively, and I think seeing this inevitable turn towards the far right perhaps broke him in a little way. And you know, it's refugees, homeless people, these are problems that just persist throughout the decades and never really get seemingly resolved. Though today, in modern times, obviously that's approached in most cases in a more humane way. Back then, I don't think treatment of homeless people or refugees was so humane or so advanced. Though, you know, I mean, the fact that there's facilities there to treat them and to give them new clothes and send them on their way to other countries, had its positive aspects as well. He sort of did a halfway house before they continued their lives outside of Germany, for example. So this is quite a complex guy, and I flicked through the book. So I've read half of it, and there's passages at the second half of the book where he's talking about people in bars, and he's quite scathing and critical of the people he mentions or that he sees in those bars, and in other parts as well. You know, in some senses, you feel like he's criticizing them. He's talking about like a woman in one bar who has a gold tooth and she wants to show it off. So she kind of sits on some guy's lap and kind of holds her head back when she's laughing because somebody has to see it, you know. And you know, in some sense, it's kind of like ridiculous. It is, and the book is full of these absurd scenes. But again, human life is so absurd that, you know, some people will do that. I have a new gold tooth. I want to show it to everybody. But also as well, it's kind of like, well, this is all she has. She doesn't have much more. And I think behind it all, there's a great well of sympathy for people like that. And he talks about criminals with some sympathy as well, because, well, some of them are bad people, like in all walks of life, but other people are there because of economic necessity. And they're all part of the great fabric of the city. And he basically talks about the different cafes and the etiquette in the rich cafes and what happens in the poor cafes, for example. So like the real writer hangouts are the ones where the writers are passed out in their tables and can sleep for hours. And in the fancy cafes, waiters with white gloves kind of expect payment straight away, but they're trained and educated enough to move along if payment isn't forthcoming. So all these kind of little social niceties that either are in evidence in upper classes or kind of dissipate as you go down the social ladder. So as you said, he's a great observer. He has seemingly been everywhere, has talked to everybody, and has done everything. And they're slowly translating all of his novels, his kind of memoirs or his observations. And I think, you know, every year there's more of his body of work available in the English-speaking world. And this book in particular has great pictures from back in the day, and posters. There's even a chapter about the unnamed dead, which is a great chapter because it talks about people who are found and their faces betray the moment of their death. And like hundreds of photographs in the police station, nobody pays any attention to them because they're there because if you recognize them, you can kind of take them from the mass grave, but from the unidentified person's grave and put them in a proper burial plot. And he was in the police station frequently because he was a foreign national and he had to go kind of renew his papers and everything as well. So he's kind of making the comment that everybody walked past him. They were like an afterthought, you know. So he was a guy who was greatly concerned with humanity in all its forms, which including what happens post-humanity, basically, when you're dead. So, and he writes fantastic pieces. He writes very poetically. I'll try and find another passage here, which is in the introduction. Yeah, he talked about Berlin. He had, even when he left Berlin permanently to live elsewhere, he kind of came back quite often, until it kind of became impossible with Nazism. He goes, the city, he said, exists outside Germany, outside Europe. It is its own capital. It does not draw supplies from the land. It obtains nothing from the earth on which it's built. It converts this earth into asphalt, bricks, and walls. It shades the plain with its houses. It supplies the plain with bread from its factories. It determines the plain's dialect, its national mores, its national costume. It's the very embodiment of a city. It has its own animal kingdom in the zoological gardens and the aquarium, the aviary, and the monkey house. Its own vegetation in the botanic gardens. Its own stretches of sand on which foundations are laid and factories erected. It even has its own harbour. Its river is a sea. It is a continent. It nourishes the natives of Dusseldorf, of Cologne, of Breslau, and draws nourishment from them. It has no culture of its own, as Breslau, Cologne, Frankfurt, Königsberg. It has no religion. It is the most hideous churches in the world. It has no society. But it has everything that society alone provides in every other city. Theatres, art, a stock exchange, trade, cinema, subways. And he's talking about Berlin, basically. Because even like in Madrid, Madrid wasn't, when it became the capital, it was like a backwater. Straight around Valladolid, Toledo, and it became a city. That was, which we know now today is the capital, and Berlin became the primary city. And but at the time when this started happening, it wasn't seen as a great city. There are other more vibrant cities with more things, and he's basically describing that there. But it always has had culture, and even after the fall of the Berlin Wall, it has retained, even in modern times, that kind of cultural cachet. So, you know, that's. Kind of the book in a snapshot. Mm-hmm. Speaking of botanical gardens, we were there earlier though, aren't we?
Speaking of botanical gardens, we were.
That's called a segue.
lovely place.
Yeah.
And we're having nice weather now, so it was great. Yeah, there are lots of species.
Of flowers.
Flowers, plants, trees, and... This even kind of like an area, like a rainforest, and it's called like the humidity conditions, it reproduces everything as well, because the plants obviously need their environment to grow.
Exactly.
So it's quite interesting. You see, there are botanical gardens in many cities, so you kind of like tend to forget about those places. But it's definitely a really nice place to hang around and, you know, read a book or... Have a chat.
Exactly. And there's a lot of steam in the greenhouse.
Yes, well.
So they've replicated the tropical conditions.
Yeah, jungle.
So it's a nice place to go. It's only €2.
Well, €2 for students. It's €4 for everybody else.
Yeah.
But, well.
We last Monday,
mm-hmm.
before that bird... Shout out over your car.
Oh, shut up. Thanks for the reminder.
Well, I was the one cleaning it. Anyway, we went to...
In your drink.
We went to the Kaiser Forum, which is... Well, you know what it is. But for the benefit of our dear listeners, it's Kaiser's a bank. The Forum is like this kind of cultural space, like a museum.
Yeah, excuse for tax evasion.
Exactly, yeah. we kind of saw something that linked a little bit to what I was talking about with this Joseph Roth fella. We've been talking about cafe culture in general, kind of in the background, off air, because we do talk off air as well, about how, like, in England, for example, it was part of this great intellectual tradition of discussion, debate, dissection animals, Isaac Newton dissected a dolphin or something, in one of these cafes, it was kind of like a real thriving intellectual hub, and nowadays just Java and cost ads, Starbucks ads, free Wi-Fi. Can you explain to us, Dr. Correas, how the exhibition kind of can link in with this kind of, you know, global cafe thing that we've been kind of discussing?
Well, Well, I'm not going to explain very much because I think we can talk about this next week.
Okay, we're out of time because somebody has to go. So we're going to... okay, I'm in trouble now. So, well, we're going to... Yeah, well, yeah, I'll stop talking.
I think it's worth you know, a podcast of its own.
You're right. So, well, without further ado, part two is over. Stay tuned for part three. Or as I say in Berlin, part three. What I saw in Levapiés, people pissing on cars, more to follow.
Mm-hmm. And story, that Joseph Roth can
leave. Story in the works about that. If you're from Madrid, I think you can relate. If not, just imagine a place that's beautiful, but also has a faint stench of urine. Nevertheless, we're coming towards the end of this podcast. Next week, we can do another podcast because I'll be in Ireland until Thursday morning. But I'm going to be back in the Thursday afternoon and we can do the podcast on Thursday after we catch up, of course.
Of course.
How was your Easter? Easter eggs. I will talk about the exactly.
You need more coffee, I think.
No, I was just doing that for effect. You know, I think we need more special effects, sound effects in this podcast. So, well, that's it.
Have a nice Easter.
Have a nice Easter from ARPA. And
don't eat too many Easter eggs.
Do whatever you do. Jadedly and apathetically signing off is Enda and
Maria.
Bye, I guess.
Bye.
Sure.
Bye.
You're listening to Subsound Radio. We bring you streaming and live broadcasting from the capital. This is the ARPA podcast.